This is Jeff Blankfort, welcoming you to the September 27th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. Hurricanes Irma and Maria have devastated many of the islands in the Caribbean, but this time Haiti, hit the hardest by many of the hurricanes in the past, was largely spared, while the Dominican Republic, with which it shares the island of Hispaniola, was battered by high winds and rain. Haiti already had enough problems. It is still recovering from the devastating earthquake in January 2010 that took the lives of more than 200,000 people and destroyed the country's infrastructure, and Hurricane Matthew last year, in which another thousand perished. While many stateside volunteers, including some from Mendocino County, went to Haiti to help in reconstruction and provide needed medical and social services, more typical of the U.S. organizational response to the earthquake was that of the American Red Cross. It took in $488 million in tax-exempt donations and ended up building just six houses. NPR reported on that story 2 years ago, and it came up again after Hurricane Harvey when some questioned whether they should send donations to the Red Cross. It didn't help the relief organization's reputation when a representative could not tell NPR host what percentage of the contributions to the Red Cross were actually used to assist disaster victims. The Red Cross's fumbled efforts in Haiti in 2010 seem to be in keeping with the real goal of the 26-member International Interim Haiti Reconstruction Commission, headed by Bill Clinton and Haitian Prime Minister Jean-Max Bellerive, that convened in June 2010. That committee was set up to oversee the $5.3 billion in U.S. dollars pledged internationally for the first 2 years of Haiti's reconstruction. Haitian groups criticized the commission at the time for lacking Haitian civil society representation and accountability mechanisms. Half the representation on the commission was given to foreigners who effectively bought their seats by pledging certain amounts of money. An international development consultant contacted by the commission was quoted as saying, "Look, you have to realize the commission was not intended to work as a structure or entity for Haiti or Haitians. It was simply designed as a vehicle for donors to funnel multinationals and NGOs, project contracts." That's just one aspect of Haiti's problems. Another is the epidemic of cholera that was brought to Haiti by Nepalese members of the UN peacekeeping forces that were sent there in 2004 following the second coup against Jean-Bertrand Aristide, Haiti's first democratically elected president. By the time the UN admitted culpability in 2010, over 10,000 Haitians were dead. This coming Saturday, September 30th, will be the 26th anniversary of the first coup against Aristide. And at 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking with Pierre Laboissière, longtime Haitian activist and co-founder of the Berkeley-based Haiti Action Committee, about Aristide, the Lavalas movement that supported him, and the current wave of protest against another U.S. puppet government. So stay tuned for that. Sunday's elections in Germany saw the latest fallout from America's post-9/11 wars. The successful immersion into the heart of German politics of an extreme right-wing party calling itself the Alternative for Germany. Its origins are strikingly similar to parties that have sprung up across Europe since the U.S. invaded and dismantled Iraq, deposing Saddam Hussein, then overthrew Muammar Gaddafi, resulting in the dismemberment of Libya and opening the continent to a flow of refugees that hasn't stopped. That despite the impact those wars have had on Europe and Africa, the U.S. continues to support forces trying to take down Bashar al-Assad and break up Syria is a clear indication that the war makers in Washington have learned no lessons from their crimes, nor has the public or any world body held them to account. So I would argue the Alternative for Germany party, or AFD, is our baby. Its success is symptomatic of the continent's growing xenophobic racist response with Nazi overtones to the arrival at its borders of, one might say, the more fortunate among the millions of brown and black refugees and economic immigrants that Washington's wars have engendered. Thousands of them have perished in the waters off of Italy, more than 5,000 in 2016 alone. That's on us, too. Truly, we are the indispensable nation. What other power could have sparked what appears to be the resurgence of fascism in Europe? And there's little evidence, sadly, that any segment of the American public has even a clue or care about it. The AFD won 12.6% of the votes for Bundestag. putting it behind the Social Democratic Party's 20.5%, which finished in second place, but ahead of the Free Democrats, who only garnered 10.7%, with the Greens at 9.6%. AfD's success was a big story coming out of the election, since Angela Merkel's winning a fourth term was largely expected, although not her low poll numbers. As Germany's leading newsweekly Der Spiegel described it, quote, "The election result for the party is devastating, with only 33% of voters casting ballots for the CDU and its Bavarian sister party, the Christian Social Union. This is the second worst election result in the conservatives' history." Even so, magazine writes, "The young men and women celebrated as though Angela Merkel had just enjoyed a landslide victory. Upstairs on the sixth floor, where there are no cameras present or any need to play things down, a different atmosphere was palpable. By 5 p.m., Merkel and her fellow party members knew that the election result would be catastrophic. Up to that point, pollsters had been predicting the party would garner between 34 and 37% of the vote. That wouldn't have been thrilling, but it would have been a result the party could explain to voters. And then came the shock. 33% or possibly less. Nobody had predicted such a lousy showing. At first, no one said anything," Der Spiegel article continued. "The state governors, government ministers, and members of the Conservative National Committee who had gathered all waited to see how the chancellor would react. We are going to hold our line," Merkel said. She had already decided on the language that would be used that afternoon, as the CDU had achieved all strategic goals, that it had scored more votes than any other party, that it had the mandate to form a government. During a TV discussion with heads of the national parties broadcast live just after the first results came out, Merkel said she was not disappointed with her party's showing. "Seldom has Merkel bent the truth so far," noted Der Spiegel. Since the Social Democrats had their worst showing in years, the party leadership said it would need to rebrand itself and would not rejoin Merkel's Christian Democrats as part of a governing coalition as it had in the past, putting pressure on the chancellor that she hadn't previously experienced. Der Spiegel's opinion writer Klaus Blinkhammer was pessimistic. "It seems clear that what will have to happen now," he wrote. "A coalition matching Merkel's Christian Democrats, its Bavarian sister party, the Christian Social Union, with the business-friendly Free Democrats and the Green Party, almost certainly under the leadership of a Merkel who suddenly seems shrunk and faint-hearted and whose days as her party's leader no longer seem infinite," end quote. There was one other aspect of the AfD success story that is causing concerns in Israel. The day after the election, one of its leaders questioned whether the country's national interests include Israel's existence. Alexander Golan, one of AfD's leaders, questioned Merkel's declared policy of a special bilateral relationship. "If Israel's existence is part of the German national interest," he said at a party press conference on Monday, using the German term Staatsräson, or reasons of state, "then we would have to be prepared to send German soldiers to defend the Jewish state. If this is the case," he said, "then the issue is problematic and difficult as far as he's concerned. It's clear that Israel's existence is an important point for us, but to turn it into a national interest, it sounds so simple, but there is continuous war in Israel. The implications of national interest," he said, "is that we would need to be really prepared to sacrifice our lives for the state of Israel," end quote. That's from AfD's leader, one of his leaders, Golan. Israeli Prime Minister sent a message of congratulations to Merkel, which did not mention the AfD's success. If anyone was wondering, by the way, if the Russians had been involved in the election, a headline in the New York Times gave the answer, quote, "One surprise, the German elections is already clear. No Russian meddling," end quote. While Germans were going to the ballot boxes, Trump was waging a Twitter war against the predominantly black players of America's most popular and profitable sport, professional football, using such abusive language that the team's multimillionaire owners felt obliged to join their players in not only chastising the resident on Twitter, but refusing to stand for the national anthem, the playing of which has become a tradition at the start of most major American sports contests. If the movement to boycott the anthem keeps growing, and every indication is that it will, since there are 14 more weeks left in the National Football League season, who knows, but former San Francisco 49er quarterback Colin Kaepernick, who was the first to do so, may end up being his generation's Rosa Parks, even if no team hires him. By Tuesday, Trump was back with his war of words against North Korea and its leader's Kim Jong-un, although the tone of his rhetoric was only slightly lower than it was a week ago when he made his first speech to the United Nations. There he used the UN podium to warn Kim that, quote, "The United States has great strength and patience, but if forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea," end quote. This led the Washington Post Aaron Blake to write, "Trump's perhaps oddly chosen colloquialism masked what was a pretty astounding escalation of his rhetoric when it comes to North Korea. Just to be clear, the president of the United States threatened to wipe a country of 25 million people off the map," end quote. Aaron Blake from the Washington Post. Well, that was just fine with Israel's Benjamin Netanyahu, who has been pressuring Trump to walk away from the Iran nuclear agreement. "In over 30 years of my experience with the UN," Netanyahu tweeted, "I have never heard a bolder or more courageous speech," end quote. What Netanyahu thought was a courageous speech apparently led North Korea's foreign minister, Ri Yong-ho, to say on Monday that Trump had declared war on North Korea and that Pyongyang reserves the right to take countermeasures, including shooting down U.S. strategic bombers, even if they are not in the country's airspace. "The whole world should clearly remember that it was the U.S. who first declared war on our country," Ri told reporters in New York. He made his comments in front of the UN before leaving New York, where he had attended the meeting of the General Assembly. After reaching his car, he turned and came back to the press microphones to add, "In light of the declaration of war by Trump, all options will be on the operations table of the supreme leadership of DPRK, Democratic People's Republic of Korea. U.S. media outlets noted his words mirrored warnings from the Trump administration that all options were on the table in dealing with North Korea's nuclear and missile development and its perceived threats. At yesterday's press conference at the White House with Spanish Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy in the Rose Garden, Trump said the U.S. is, quote, "totally prepared for devastating military action against North Korea should that be necessary. That's called the military option. If we have to take it, we will," he said, adding that while it was not the preferred course, the U.S. was nonetheless totally prepared for it," end quote. His preferred course for the moment is to try to bring North Korea to its knees economically with ever-increasing sanctions, which past history shows is not likely to work. There have been questions raised as to why the U.S. has made no attempt to shoot down any of the missiles launched by North Korea over Japan. In response, War Secretary General Jim Mattis said it was not necessary since they represented no danger to Japan or to the U.S. There are some others who think that the U.S. may have hesitated because there's no assurance that the U.S. missile would have hit those fired by the North Koreans in flight, since so many past tests that involve shooting down incoming missiles have ended in failure. And that's when all aspects of the test were under the Pentagon's control. Failure to intercept a North Korean missile would be, under the present circumstances, an unacceptable humiliation for Washington on the world stage. And meanwhile, the battle of male egos will no doubt continue. At the same time Trump has been threatening North Korea, he has also been making noises about pulling the U.S. out of the agreement with Iran that also includes the other four members of the U.N. Security Council plus Germany, none of whom are inclined thus far to support him. He is being pressured to do so not only by Netanyahu, but by the full panoply of pro-Israel lobbies and think tanks that failed to get their way with President Obama. Quite apart from the agreement itself, Congress requires the president to certify that Iran is in compliance with the stricter days, and although Trump has repeatedly called it the worst deal ever made, up to now he has grudgingly done so since there have been no evidence that Iran had committed any violations. The next deadline for his signature is October 15th, and from his musings and grumblings and calling it, quote, "an embarrassment to the United States" in his UN speech, it seems that Trump is going to find a way that lets Congress, presumably the Senate, make the decision over certification. Given the Senate's total subservience to Israel and its domestic lobby, AIPAC, this would be tantamount to Trump pulling the U.S. out of the agreement itself. What Trump is demanding is that the agreement be renegotiated to include the shutting down of Iran's ballistic missile program and eliminating the sunset clause that would permit Tehran, after a 10-year hiatus, to resume its nuclear enrichment program, which it totally shut down as part of the agreement. The same points were emphasized last week by Secretary of State Rex Tillerson speaking to Fox News. "The president really wants to redo that deal," he said. "We do need the support, I think, of our allies, the European allies, and others to make the case, as well as to Iran, this deal really has to be revisited," end quote. In signing the agreement, Tehran gave up much of its sovereignty, and given Netanyahu's frequent threats to take unilateral military action against Iran, it's not about to give up anymore. Speaking to the UN General Assembly last Wednesday, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani praised the deal as a model, arguing that the Middle East was safer for it. He said, "It would be a great pity if this agreement were to be destroyed by rogue newcomers to the world of politics. The world will have lost a great opportunity," end quote. As the New York Times reported, the Iranian president sought to flip the script on the Trump administration's contention that Iran destabilizes the Middle East. He said the American taxpayers should ask why billions of dollars spent in the region had not advanced peace and only, quote, brought war, misery, poverty, and the rise of extremism to the region, end quote. The ignorant absurd and hateful rhetoric filled with ridiculously baseless allegations that was uttered before this august body yesterday, Rouhani said, referring to Trump's speech, was, quote, unfit to be heard at the United Nations, which was established to promote peace and respect between nations, end quote. Observers across the political spectrum, not in Israel's embrace, acknowledge that the message the Trump administration would be sending to North Korea should it walk out of the agreement with Iran was that the United States could not be trusted. That's something all of this country's indigenous nations learned long ago. This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks very much for listening.